carefully predicts its own downfall in singularities. And remember that that's a non-trivial question, even though we know that there are solutions to the Einstein equation that have singularities in them, like cosmological solutions may have a Big Bang singularity, and black hole solutions have a singularity at the center of the black hole. But then we said, well, maybe in a generic case, we don't actually have these singularities. Consider, for example, an infall of matter. If it's completely spherically symmetric, we will end up with a Schwarzschild solution. But if it's not completely symmetric, we may not. It's not obvious. We cannot solve the equations of motion exactly in this case. And a classical analogy illustrates why this is non-trivial. Imagine you have two billiard balls that are attracted to each other, let's say gravitationally. Now, if you just let them attract each other, they might crash into each other, and you could consider having a singularity there. But imagine that you have two objects like billiard balls that attract each other, but the initial condition is such that they miss each other. Even if it's just by a tiny little bit, then they will miss each other, and they will interact strongly when they're close, but then they fly off in another direction. So no crash. So you could imagine that if you have a spherical collapse, but it's not completely spherical, you could have a similar situation where the matter is basically missing each other, and you don't get a collapse into a black hole. So how do we know that general relativity really predicts as a generic feature its own breakdown in cosmological or black hole solutions? So what we are aiming at, what the mission we are on now, is to get to singularity theorems that say something like, under very generic conditions, a singularity is unavoidable. Now, in order to get there, and at the end of the lecture today, we will see the first singularity theorem. We will not yet be ready to prove it, but just to state it. In order to get there, we first need to clear up a few things about causality in general relativity. Okay, so let's start with causality. We say that a space-time given by differentiable manifold and a metric is causal, so it obeys causality, if it does not contain closed causal, that is, time or null curves. Now you might think, okay, so that does it, that's a good definition. We just say, okay, movies may have these closed time-like curves, but reality does not, and close chapter. But it's not that easy. You see, you could have space-times which are causal, so they don't have closed time-like curves, they don't have closed null curves, but they could almost have that. Remember, we started discussing that at the end of the previous lecture. So imagine a space-time in the shape of the surface of a can, just a cylinder, right? And these things are not ice cream cones, they're meant to be the forward light cones. Okay, so I just picked up a few points and I drew the forward light cones. You see, some of them are tilted here to the right. That will have a significance in a moment. Imagine to start with that all of these ice cream cones, all of these future pointing light cones, are upwards. So they are all like this, like Minkowski space, right? Imagine they would all be like that. Then how could we travel in such a space-time? Well, only forward in time, of course, which means all the paths would be like this on that cylinder, right? Because we have to stay inside of the light cone. So we could be as shallow as 45 degrees, almost 45 degrees would be the speed of light. We could be as shallow as 45 degrees, but not any shallower. That would be more than the speed of light, and also to the left. So if all the light cones were like these, pointing upwards, then we could only travel like this, right? But this space-time is special. It has light cones that are also, some of them are tilted to the right. So here they are pretty much as usual. Here they are pretty much as usual in Minkowski space, but here somehow the curvature is such that the light cones are tilted. You know, tilted light cones, you get close to the horizon of a black hole, for example. So it's not a weird thing. Okay, so we have these tilted light cones. But notice that none of these light cones actually tilts all the way to 45 degrees. At least if I drew them more carefully, that would be the case. This one looks like it has, you know, like it's basically horizontal. But imagine that all of these light cones have their right boundary just above horizontal. In this case, how would our allowed trajectories look like? Light-like and time-like trajectories would look like this. Down here, they have to be somewhere here, but over there, they have to be somewhere there, and then they go like this again, right? This is how it looks like. Now imagine that these light cones were actually tilting all the way so that the lower boundary of the light cone dips a little bit below the horizontal. In this case, our trajectories could go like this, but they could also go like this and keep going around like that forever, right? Because the manifold is the surface of a can, right? And if the light cones are such that they tilt like this, right, then forward in time is like this way, and you can go around the can, and you can just always go around. You have closed time-like curves. Now, what I tried to plot here is the case where the space-time is in danger of this happening. The light cones are just above the horizontal. Therefore, all trajectories that a traveler could travel on will have to go upwards. But if the light cones were just a little bit to tilt further down, then we could run into having closed time-like curves. And the manifold would be acausal. So that means this is a space-time which is very close to being acausal. It is causal, but it's super close to being acausal. So you could imagine a little bit of a perturbation. You throw a stone there, it curves space, the light cones tilt a little bit, and bang, you have a closed time-like curve, right? So the existence or non-existence of a closed time-like curve is not something that is topologically protected. It's not something that you would have to make huge changes for, global changes for. It can arise from local changes of the metric. That's very important because it's a little counterintuitive, but I think that picture illustrates that. So we say that a space-time is strongly causal if it is not at risk. Not at risk, that's the next definition. What strongly causal means is that the space-time is not arbitrarily close to possessing closed time-like or light-like curves. So the definition is that the space-time is strongly causal if it is causal, right? So there are no closed time-like curves, but also for all events and all neighborhoods of these events, there is a neighborhood smaller than the original neighborhood. I hope that's not too confusing. I'm explaining it again in a moment. So that no causal curve gamma intersects that smaller neighborhood more than once. So what does that mean? It means that in the picture up here, we can pick a point like here, and we pick a neighborhood of that point. Then the definition says that the space-time is strongly causal if there is a sub-neighborhood of that point such that any causal curve that goes through our point passes through that smaller sub-neighborhood at most once. That's important because if that's not true, then you have trajectories that will pass by our point again arbitrarily close. Because you could choose a point, choose a neighborhood that's arbitrarily small, and then there would exist a sub-neighborhood of that, which would be crossed by that trajectory again. And since you can choose that neighborhood, that initial neighborhood arbitrarily small, and smaller and smaller and smaller, you would always find that there's always a trajectory there, which means that a space-time which is not strongly causal has the feature that there exists at least one point where in arbitrarily small neighborhoods you have a recurrence of a path, right? And that means that it's arbitrarily close to being an acausal space-time. Okay, so if the space-time is not strongly causal, then there exists a causal curve gamma which comes arbitrarily close to intersecting itself. Because there is a point for which you can choose arbitrarily small neighborhoods and the curve will come back. So definitely, we expect that space-time is strongly causal in order to keep causal curves. And remember what a causal curve is. A causal curve is a curve that's either light-like or time-like. So we expect space-time to be such that it is strongly causal in order to keep causal curves at least a finite distance from intersecting themselves. Otherwise, the space-time would just not be stable in that sense. And remember that there's always fluctuations. If need be, you can refer to quantum fluctuations that would force it, right? So if a space-time was not strongly causal, then a small fluctuation could give us, of the metric, for example, could give us closed time-like curves. So strong causality rules that out. Now, let's address that underlying problem head on, namely arbitrarily small perturbations in the metric, but finite ones, could allow causal curves to self-intersect. So, to control this, let us consider the stability of space-time under perturbations of the metric. And we can do this in this way. We start with the metric that the space-time actually has, and then we look at the perturbed metric to it. The perturbed metric we will call G tilde, and is defined to be the original metric minus omega mu omega nu, where omega mu omega nu is a time-like cotangent vector field. First of all, this is going to be a metric again. This is a small perturbation. This is symmetric in mu nu. So it's a covariant symmetric two tensor. It's definitely symmetric under this. Now, we could also consider different perturbations of the metric, but these perturbations of the metric are the dangerous ones. And that's why we will consider them. Let me explain in a moment why these are the perturbations of the metric that we need to worry about. The reason why these are interesting perturbations of the metric is that this metric will have light cones that are wider than the light cones of the original metric. But having wider light cones makes it riskier, right? Because then, even if with the old metric, you couldn't have closed time-like curves, once you open the light cone further, then you could have closed time-like curves. So let's see why G tilde has wider light cones than G does. So let us compare the length of a vector v with respect to the metric G tilde and the length of a vector v with respect to the original actual metric of the space-time, G. So the length of a vector with respect to the metric G tilde, the perturbed metric, is by definition of G tilde the length of the vector with respect to the original metric minus, and then you have this inner product here. You have the V mu omega mu squared. Since this expression is multiplied with itself, it's positive, but we are subtracting it, right? Because the perturbation of the metric was such that we are subtracting this. Minus sign is important. Why? Well, because it means that the length of a vector with respect to G tilde is always smaller than the length of the same vector with respect to the original metric. But remember that time-likeness in our convention for the metric is negativity of the length, right? So if you have a vector whose length is negative, I mean its length squared is negative, that's a time-like vector. Or it's a tangent vector to a path along which we could travel. So what we have overall is that the length of a vector with respect to G tilde is always smaller than the length of the same vector with respect to the actual metric of the space-time. This means that it's easier for vectors V to be time-like or null for G tilde than for G, because we have an extra negativity in this. So it's easier for a vector to have negative length squared with respect to G tilde than with respect to G. And that means more vectors meet the criterion that they are time-like or null with respect to G tilde than with respect to G, which is exactly the statement that the light cone is wider. It's more open. So that's why we should consider these perturbations there. You see, so what we have is that the space-time equipped with the metric G tilde has all the causal curves of the metric of the space-time with the metric G and more, because more tangent vectors are now considered time-like or light-like than were before. So this space-time has more causal curves than the actual original space-time. It has the same one as the ones before, but more. So this suggests this definition. We say that a space-time is stably causal if there exists such an omega, a time-like vector field, such that even the space-time equipped with the wider light cones is still causal. So that gives us a kind of safety margin, because it means that even if we widen all the light cones by a bit, as defined by the vector field omega, even if we widen all light cones by a little bit, we still don't have closed time-like or closed light-like curves. So the notion of stably causal is expressing that we have a safety margin here. Even if the light cones were a little bit wider open, we still wouldn't have closed time-like curves. That is what it means when we say that the space-time is stably causal. Now, if the space-time is stably causal, then it's no surprise that theorem one holds, which is to say that the space-time is also strongly causal, right? If it is causal even when the light cones are widened, then clearly we have that it's strongly causal, which means that we don't have any curves that get arbitrarily close to self-intersecting. Now, the next theorem is very interesting, and it relates to something that we saw earlier. So the theorem says that if a space-time is stably causal, so if we have such, if such a vector field exists, so that we have the safety margin with the width of the light cones, if it is stably causal, the space-time, then there exists a differentiable function f such that its gradient is a path-directed time-like vector field. Of course, you could also say future directed if you, yeah, it's the same thing. Now, first of all, what does it mean and how does it relate to what we saw earlier? This theorem means that if the space-time is stably causal, then there exists such a function, and this function can then be viewed as a cosmic clock. Right? So it can be viewed as a cosmic clock. It's a function whose amplitude can basically tell us the time. It gives us a notion of time. Remember that in general relativity, there is no unique notion of time. You can always reparameterize your clocks, but that's a notion of time. We know that it can work as a clock because its gradient, that is the direction in which it is changing, is path directed, or if we, I mean, it's just traditionally that we choose the path directed here, but you could also say future directed. So if you travel into the past or into the future, then this function's value is monotonically increasing or decreasing. So it's a reliable clock in that sense. If you travel on a time-like curve or light-like curve, then your time variable, the f, will be monotonically increasing or decreasing depending on whether you travel to the future or to the past. So there exists such a clock function. Now, remember that earlier in this course, we had the notion of time orientability, which was saying that a space-time is time-orientable if you can always uniquely distinguish the forward from the backward light cones, the future from the past, in a continuous fashion. So it's not a Möbius strip. Space-time is not a space-time Möbius strip. And we had this theorem that a space-time is time-orientable if there exists a path-pointing smooth time-like vector field. How is that related to this here? Well, here we have a function and its vector field, and that's a path-directed time-like vector field. You see, time orientability is a weaker condition than stable causality. And you see it mathematically here in the requirement that there simply exists a path-pointing smooth time-like vector field. That's what is needed for time orientability. But there's no requirement that that vector field is the gradient of a scalar function. Right? You get more than time orientability, namely stable causality, if you also require that this path-pointing smooth time-like vector field is the gradient of some function f. All right, so what's our plan then on our mission to get to singularity theorems? Well, first of all, we will assume that space-time is stably causal. This means that travelers cannot go on cyclic paths, and they're also not on risks. They're not at risk to go on a closed time-like loop. And that means that when we have inextendable paths, one of the three possibilities is now eliminated. One of the possibilities for why a path is inextendable was that the path just goes round and round in circles, closed time-like curve. The other possibilities that are still remaining are that our path, our trajectory, goes on to infinity. We will have to deal with this case though. And then the remaining possibility is the one that we are interested in, which is that the path is inextendable because it ran into a singularity. So with this causality business, we eliminated one possibility now. We are saying, okay, space-time ought to be stably causal, so we are eliminating the possibility that we have that a path is inextendable simply because it just keeps running in closed time-like curves. So for example, if we know that there's a cosmic clock, if there's a cosmic clock function, then we know that that possibility is eliminated. If there's a scalar function whose gradient is path directed, and then everywhere and smoothly, then we know that the spacetime is stably causal. Okay, so we need to study those two cases then. So we continue to study inextendable curves, inextendable paths, well, time-like and light-like paths. And the study of the inextendable curves, inextendable time-like and light-like curves, will now lead us to, I mean, one hand, we need to study this for the purpose of getting to the singularity theorems, but also along the way, we will uncover important concepts, namely the concept of Cauchy horizon and global hyperbolicity. Okay, so let's remember a definition from the previous lecture. We considered the set of points I plus of s or j plus of s, which is the set of all those points or all those events that can be reached from some set S. Right? So we said consider some set of events S and then look at all those events that can be reached, that can be influenced by events on S, namely that can be reached by time-like or light-like curves from S. That's what we studied last time. And in this way, we ended up also recovering the definition of what is an event horizon and all of that. Now, the question of which events can be influenced from a set S of events is important, and we covered it last lecture. Now, we look at a reverse question, which is to say, which events can only be influenced by events from S. Let me show you the difference of that. So the definition is this. Assume that S is a closed achronal set. Achronal, remember, is a set of events is achronal if there cannot be any time-like curves, if there are no time-like curves between any two events there. So consider just think of a space-like hypersurface. So assume that S is a closed achronal set. Then the future domain of dependence of S is, roughly speaking, the set of all those events which can be fully predicted if you know only what happened on S. So it's a set of all those events that have all of their stuff in their past happening on S. The exact definition is this. The future domain of dependence of a set of events S is denoted by D plus of S. And it is the set of all those events for which it is true that every past inextendable causal curve through this point intersects our set S. Now that's much easier explained on a diagram than in formulas. So here's an example. Imagine this line here represents the set of events S, some space-like hypersurface, for example. Then we ask, what is the set of events that are influenced only by S? That's what D plus is. It's a set of events that are influenced only by S. For example, let's consider an event right here. What is it influenced by? Well, let's look at its past light cone. It goes like this and like that. And you see, all past directed curves will intersect S. So what happens over here cannot be influenced by anything outside S, right? Because the light cones, I mean, the light cannot travel there, right? It would be too shallow. So an event right here, what happens at this event is completely determined by initial conditions here. So if you have, for example, the initial conditions of all the physical fields and the metric right here, that's just the physical fields, then you should be able to run forward the equations of motion and determine exactly what happens at that event. Now, let's consider an event here. Now, that event here is partially influenced by what happened here on that red curve. But it's also partially influenced what happened here, right? Events that happened here can influence this. But events here can also influence that. So that's a point that is affected by what happened here, but not only. The events inside here, however, are affected only by what happens on S. So if you know the initial conditions of your physical fields on S, this is what you can predict from it. You can only guess what might happen here and there, but you can predict what happens in here. That's therefore the future domain of dependence of S. Now you may wonder what happened over here. Well, just for the heck of it, I drew a singularity there. I just took a point out of the manifold to illustrate what happens if you do this. So if you take a point out of the manifold here, then these events suddenly are no longer in the future domain of dependence of S. Let's consider this point Q here. In order to be an element of D plus of S, this point would have to have the property that every past inextendable causal curve through P, or in this case through Q, intersects S. Now, here I'm drawing a past inextendable curve. Extendable means I just keep going, right? So I draw some curves, past inextendable curves, and you see all of them, they have to be within the past light cone, right? I draw all of them, and they intersect our red curve, fine. So that's good. But how about this curve? It's a past inextendable smooth curve that is inextendable because it hit a singularity, but it doesn't intersect S because it's already inextendable here. Another curve that I go like this is inextendable because it runs to infinity. Right? I just don't stop it. But this particular curve is a past inextendable curve, inextendable because it ran into a singularity, and yet it doesn't intersect S. Therefore, Q doesn't qualify as an element of D plus, because the elements of the future domain of dependence of S have to have the property that every past inextendable causal curve from that point has to intersect S somewhere. And this curve is an example of a curve that doesn't. So what we see is that the singularity leaves a kind of shadow here in this. Okay. And similarly, we can define the past domain of dependence of S, where you just flip the role of future and past. And this is the set of all those events that affect only S, that don't affect anything outside S, right? So if we plot this again, here we go. So for example, an event here would be in the past domain of dependence because it affects only S, right? So all causal curves from that event into the future will intersect S. An event over here, for example, has the property that of its future-directed curves don't intersect S. The events here have the property that some future-directed curves will affect S and some won't. But the past domain of dependence is the set of all points in here. All points in here have the property that they affect only S. Right? So if there was no singularity, this would be a thing like this, a cone like that, and over there like this, and the whole thing would be called a causal diamond. Okay, so we have the future domain of dependence of S, and we have the past domain of dependence of S. Past domain of dependence of S being defined as the set of all those events of the manifold, which have the property that every future inextendable causal curve through P intersects S, right? So that's what's in this lower triangle there. And then we define the full domain of dependence of S, also sometimes called the causal diamond, as the union of the future domain of dependence and the past domain of dependence of S. Now, let's look at the boundary of that. You see, when we look at this picture here again, what we see is that on here, we may choose to impose initial conditions, and then we run the Euler Lagrange equations forward. We run the equations of motion forward, like the Klein-Gordon equation, the Maxwell equations, and so on. Then, how far into the future can we predict with this? Well, we can predict everything in here, except that this singularity left us a shadow in here, right? So we can predict all of this. All of these, whatever happens to fields in this region of space-time, we can predict just on the basis of these initial conditions and the equations of motion. And we can ask, what's the limit? How far does it go? Well, it's this much, right? That's the boundary of what we can predict if we have initial conditions on S. So let's give names to these things. We say that the future Cauchy horizon of S, denoted by H plus of S, is the closure of the future domain of dependence, and then you take away the causal, the chronological past of the future domain of dependence. Let me illustrate that. It's not a deep concept. It's pretty straightforward. So we take D plus of S, which is all of this, and then, just to make sure, we take the boundary, we take the closure of it. So by putting a bar over it, we make sure that all those points are included, right? All of these points are included. I mean, this is not a point of the manifold, we took it out. So the D plus of S is all of this, including the boundary here. And then we take away the chronological past of all of this. Right? The chronological past of all of this is the bulk in here. All of this we take away. We don't take away the causal past, we just take away the chronological past. Remember what that means? Causal means time-like or light-like. Chronological means only time-like, which means what we're taking away is only the inside, but not the boundaries, because they're light-like. Okay? So we take D plus of S, close it to get all of this, and then we subtract all the points in the bulk inside. And that gives us the future Cauchy horizon. And similarly, we can define the same thing down here, where we look at the closure of D minus of the past domain of dependence, and then subtract the chronological future, so we just get the boundary down here. That would be H minus. This will be H minus. Okay, so we defined the future Cauchy horizon of S as H plus of S. The future Cauchy horizon of S has a direct physical meaning. It's the last event that you can still predict on the basis of knowledge only on S. Right? This is as far as you can predict. This is the your horizon of predictability. Everything else you can help predict, perhaps, but you may need information from outside of S. Okay, so you see, it's yet another definition of horizon. Like there's a particle horizon, event horizon, and now we got the Cauchy horizon. Okay, so here's the example. Again, we have S here, and then we have D plus, and then by taking the closure of D plus and subtracting the bulk, we obtain that H plus of S is exactly those green lines over here. And then analogously, the past Cauchy horizon of S, which is denoted by H minus of S, and it is of course the closure of the past domain of dependence minus the future, the chronological future of all of that, which is the bulk of it. And so we're just left with that boundary there. This is the set of the earliest events that affect only S, right? So all these points in here are events that affect only S, and the boundary consists of all those events, of the earliest events that affect only S. And don't affect anything else. Then the full Cauchy horizon of our S is the union of the future and the past Cauchy horizon. Right, and then a proposition that's pretty obvious is simply this, that the full Cauchy horizon, the full Cauchy horizon is the boundary of the full domain of dependence. Right? The full domain of dependence, remember, is this. If this is S, then the full domain of dependence is all of this and all of that. And then we take the boundary of that, and that's going to be the full Cauchy horizon. All right, now we get to an important concept here that you will find in the literature all over the place. A closed achronal set S is called a Cauchy surface if it is a set of events. I'm just paraphrasing now what we will see in a moment in math. A set of events, an achronal set S is called a Cauchy surface if, when you know the initial conditions of a field on that surface, then you can predict it forever and run it backwards in the past too. So if it is if it gives you a complete set of initial conditions, right? If S is large enough so that if you know the initial conditions on S, you can predict everything that ever will happen in the universe, and everything that has happened, you can post-predict. Then it's what is called a Cauchy surface. So a closed achronal set S is called a Cauchy surface if its full Cauchy horizon vanishes, which is to say that, you know, this part and that part is supposed to vanish, which means there is no latest event that you can predict. There is no earliest event that only affects S, but instead you can predict everything. The space-time not having a boundary, the Cauchy horizon also not having a boundary. So a Cauchy surface is a set S such that the full Cauchy horizon is empty, which is a weird way of saying you can predict everything. And then that, of course, means, because that is the same as the boundary of the future and past domain of dependence, of the full domain of dependence, it also says that the domain of dependence has no boundary, right? So you can predict everything. Nothing is too late to predict. You can predict everything, which is to say that the domain of dependence is the entire manifold. Now, so far in this course, we've usually followed the logic and the notation of Hawking and Ellis. But for this last part, I followed mostly Wald, because Wald is much clearer than Hawking and Ellis are on this subject. Okay, so Cauchy surfaces are important, because if the conditions of fields are known on a Cauchy surface, then everything on the spacetime can be predicted and retrodicted. For example, you may have heard about de Sitter space and anti-de Sitter space. The universe that we live in is pretty close to de Sitter space. I mean, it started out in an almost de Sitter phase, And it seems to be heading towards exponential expansion again. It seems that we are on track for a de Sitter kind expansion in the future because the cosmological constant is starting to dominate, right? But there has been a lot of work on anti-de Sitter space. One of the features that is not so nice about anti-de Sitter space is that it doesn't have Cauchy surfaces, whereas de Sitter space does have. Just if you want to read up on that, anti-de Sitter space doesn't have Cauchy surfaces. So you can't choose a space-like hypersurface on which, if the initial conditions are given there, you could predict the future. Now, in a universe that does have Cauchy surfaces, we have that these Cauchy surfaces are achronal, because remember, we assumed our set S to be achronal. These Cauchy surfaces, which you can think of as space-like hypersurfaces, can be viewed as instants in time, right? So literally as space at one point in time, such that if you give the initial conditions of a field at that point in time, then you can run the evolution forward forever, and you can retrodict also the past. The term surface for Cauchy surface was motivated by a theorem. And the theorem is that every Cauchy surface is a three-dimensional continuous submanifold of our space-time. So Cauchy surfaces are always three-dimensional. As you might imagine, right? I mean, you hold the time fixed and then you're left with a three-dimensional space. A definition that you come across a lot in the literature is global hyperbolicity. A space-time that possesses a Cauchy surface is called globally hyperbolic. That's the same thing. The possession of a Cauchy surface, and therefore the existence of a surface on which you can make impose initial conditions and then run forever into the future and into the past, is called that property is called global hyperbolicity. This notion of global hyperbolicity, the existence of a Cauchy surface, will later be important for cosmological singularity theorem. There's a proposition about globally hyperbolic space-times. Namely, if a space-time is globally hyperbolic, then there exists a global time function so that every surface of constant f is a Cauchy surface, which means that if you have a Cauchy surface, you have infinitely many Cauchy surfaces. And you can foliate your space-time like a pile of pancakes, such that every pancake represents a different time, and along the pancake you have space, and you can choose initial conditions on any one of those pancakes. But it's kind of plausible, right? Because if you have one Cauchy surface, it means you can predict all of the future, and you can just take a slice now of in the future somewhere, space-like hypersurface, and then impose initial conditions there, and you can retrodict and you can postdict again. So if you have one space-like hypersurface, which is a Cauchy surface, then yeah, you can pancake space-time, you can foliate it into continuously many space-like hypersurfaces that are all Cauchy surfaces. And it follows that if space-time is globally hyperbolic, then the space-time is also stably and therefore also strongly causal. Right? Because we have this global time function as we saw earlier. So let's remember what our mission is. We want to check for the breakdown of general relativity. Does it really predict that in realistic scenarios, singularities will develop? So our plan is to study inextendable geodesics in order to detect singularities. But a geodesic may be inextendable for various reasons. It might be that it just keeps running around and forever, and then how would you extend that? So it just already goes around forever, and that is something we excluded by making sure that we don't have closed time-like curves or light-like curves. Another possibility was that the trajectory that the geodesic just is inextendable because it just runs forever, and therefore you can't extend beyond forever. But another possibility, and that's the one we want to focus on, is the one where the geodesic is not extendable because the space-time has a singularity there. It ends there. So how can we identify those geodesics which are inextendable because they end at a singularity in the manifold? Now, first, we should avoid all those trivial cases when a manifold is ending just because somebody said it does, right? Like before, I drew a manifold for you and I just took an event out of it. Now, you can do this. You can just punch a hole into a manifold. But in this case, you could just extend the manifold, fill up that hole, and then a geodesic that previously ran into that singularity there, ran into that hole and couldn't be extended, can now be extended. The situation would be similar to, let's say, the function sine x over x. You know how that looks like? Sine x over x. If you plot that, it looks like this. It has a hole here, and then it goes like that. And the function is not defined for x equal to 0, because you would be dividing by 0. But outside, it's defined fine. And it turns out that you can extend this function by define f of x equal to sine of x over x for x not equal to 0, and define it to be 1 for x equal to 0. Now, of course, you could also define it to be a million for x equal to 0, but we have a reason why we choose this. This function f of x, which is an extension of sine x over x, so that it is also defined at x equal to 0, this function is an entire function, which means it's analytic everywhere. It can be infinitely many times differentiated everywhere, and the Taylor expansion that you get has an infinite radius of convergence. It's a function that's as nice as it gets. So this is a removable singularity for our function sine x over x. Now, why is it removable? Well, because, you know, the sine of x is approximately x for x really small. For x really small, right? And that's why you basically have a cancellation between the two. Now, in space-time too, you could have singularities of this kind, where you kind of have a hole punched into the space-time, but maybe just because your coordinates are badly chosen or something like that. That sort of thing can happen. And then you can choose coordinates differently, and everything is totally smooth. This is what happens, for example, on the horizon of a Schwarzschild black hole, if you choose Schwarzschild coordinates. Then you get that on the horizon itself, the metric seems to blow up. It's divergent, cannot be defined. But it's just like this. And you can fix this. There's nothing really happening. Nothing really blows up here. Because the limit from the left and from the right is always 1, and the whole thing extends very nicely. In the case of the Schwarzschild black hole, you simply choose different coordinates, such as Kruskal coordinates, and then you see that the metric is perfectly smooth across the horizon. When it really matters is when we have in the space-time a hole or a singularity, and the curvature is going to infinity as we approach that. And we will discuss exactly in which ways that can happen in a moment. But for now, let us make sure that we are not trivially identifying singularities which are there but could be removed by simply extending the space-time there. So we say that a space-time is inextendable. So now we are not talking about geodesics. We're talking about space-times. We are saying that a space-time is inextendable if it is not isometric to a proper subset of another spacetime. So for example, I could take a spacetime like Minkowski space and I punch a hole into it by simply saying I take out this point or I take out this disk or whatever. Well then, yeah, there's going to be inextendable geodesics that run up to that hole and then can't extend it. But that spacetime with the hole punched into it is isometric to the original spacetime without having a hole punched into it. It's a subset of it, which is to say that our Minkowski space with the hole punched into it can be extended to a proper spacetime. So we say that the spacetime is inextendable if it is not a subset of a bigger spacetime. So for example, for the black hole, the Schwarzschild solution is not a subset of a bigger spacetime, in which there wouldn't be that singularity at the beginning. We cannot simply paste that over. So in the future, now we will always assume that our spacetime has been extended as far as it can. So we are not on purpose taking away points or disks or balls or whatever. Okay. Now, another definition. A geodesic which is inextendable but possesses a finite range of its affine parameter is called incomplete. By focusing on incomplete geodesics, we are taking out one of the possibilities for why a geodesic might be extendable. Namely, one of the possibilities was that the geodesic is inextendable because it runs forever towards infinity. Sure, that's inextendable, but it doesn't mean that it ran into a singularity. So by looking at incomplete geodesics, we are focusing on geodesics that have only a finite range of their affine parameter, the parameter that parameterizes their running, right? And if it has only a finite range of its parameter, it cannot go on forever. So we will now focus on inextendable geodesics that are incomplete. And that finally allows us to define what we mean by singularity. We say that a spacetime possesses a singularity if it possesses an incomplete geodesic. So it's inextendable, but its affine parameter runs only a finite range. Of course, we're already assuming that the spacetime is globally hyperbolic, so that it doesn't have, we are assuming that we are excluding closed space-like curves. That's what we are doing. Now, there is something weird about this, which is that we did not specify here whether the geodesic is time-like, light-like, or space-like. Which means that if we specify that, we can classify our singularities. We could encounter a situation where we find a geodesic which is, let's say, light-like. And that light-like geodesic is incomplete. So it's inextendable, but its affine parameter is a finite range. So we conclude there's a singularity. In this case, we would say, we discovered a light-like singularity. It's discoverable by a light-like incomplete geodesic. If we find an incomplete time-like geodesic, then it means that we will say that we discovered a time-like singularity. But there are space-like geodesics too, of course. Now, we couldn't travel on space-like geodesics because that would be meaning traveling faster than the speed of light. Instead, we could choose a coordinate system in which the geodesic is one point in time, but extended in space, right? And that's what it means, that you have space-like, a space-like curve. That in a suitable coordinate system, this is just like a snake at one point in time. It's an extended object at one point in time. So there are very different types of singularities there. And what we will focus on here is the type of singularities that are null or time-like, which means that these would be singularities that can be discovered by travelers or by light rays. These would be the singularities that stop a traveler, like, you know, a ray of light or a clock or an astronaut. Now, when we go along an incomplete geodesic towards a singularity, then we can classify what can happen. What do you think might happen? If you travel towards a singularity, let's say it's a light-like singularity, and you're an astronaut, and you say, I don't care, I'd go there and check this thing out. What do you think will happen before you hit the singularity? Will you see something happen, or will it just hit you suddenly? It turns out both can happen. It can be that you will feel strong tidal forces that might rip you apart. That's the case for a black hole, for example. But it could also be you feel nothing until you hit it. Here's how this works. One possibility is that as you travel on your geodesic towards the singularity, one of the scalars that you can construct from the Riemann curvature tensor diverges. So it could be the Ricci scalar, or it could be something quadratic like Arminu, etc. So in this case, we say that we are approaching a scalar curvature singularity. And you would feel that. Because if the curvature is strong, it means that you have tidal forces. Strictly speaking, though, there are two kinds of curvature. There's space-space curvature, and there's space-time curvature. And space-space curvature, we have some intuition for. Space-time curvature, I think I mentioned briefly earlier. Does anybody remember what it is? When space-time has curvature between space and time?
Expansion?
Yeah, it's expansion and shrinkage, that's right. So it could be that you just shrunk or exploded, if that kind of curvature blows up towards the singularity. So in any case, there are singularities that you can construct, and that presumably nature can construct, where a scalar made out of the Riemann curvature tensor and its powers diverges. And then that we call a scalar curvature singularity. Now, it wouldn't make sense to just look at one of the coordinates, one of the matrix elements of the Riemann curvature tensor, and say, oh, does it diverge or not? Because you can always choose coordinates in a weird fashion, such that the entries of a curvature tensor take these or those values, because you can do these local Lorentz transformations there, right? You can do this more than local Lorentz transformations. You just get all of those Jacobian matrices whirling around all the coefficients of your tensor as you change coordinates. So the value of one of those coefficients in the Riemann curvature tensor does not in itself have intrinsic meaning if you allow yourself to choose arbitrary coordinates. That's why in this categorization, we were looking at the scalars that you can build from the Riemann curvature tensor. Because those scalars are, of course, coordinate system independent, because they're scalar. But the coefficients of a vector or tensor are, of course, coordinate system dependent. Except that's only true if you choose your coordinate system along with the choice of bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces, which, as we discovered earlier in this course, is not necessary. You can, in fact, choose canonical bases of your tangent and cotangent spaces in the form of tetrads, which are bases that arise from Riemann normal coordinate systems. And they are canonical. They're not human choices. Nature chooses these Riemann normal coordinate systems. Nature chooses what they are. And then if you choose the basis that comes with the Riemann normal coordinate systems, you have an orthonormal frame of basis vectors at each point. And you could choose that and then have that coordinate system independently. And in this case, the coefficients of the Riemann normal, of the Riemann curvature tensor, remember, are all scalar. They more than that, they just don't change. If you change coordinate system, you're no longer changing basis vectors in your tension and cotension spaces. So therefore, these scalars don't change as you change coordinate system. So then it makes sense to look at the individual components of the Riemann curvature tensor, because they're no longer coordinate system dependent, they're scalars now. And you can ask, do they blow up? Or does some of them, do some of them blow up? And if they do, then we say that we have a parallel propagated curvature singularity. Another possibility is that it's none of the above. We could run into a singularity, and there is no blow up of the curvature. Now you might think, okay, but that's a trivial singularity. You can paste that over because the curvature is flat there. No, there can be actually singularities where there is no extreme curvature in the neighborhood. So you wouldn't feel anything until you meet it. And you would still be crushed if you get in there. And to see that, I need a piece of paper. Remember that if you take a piece of paper and you roll it up, oh yeah, yeah, she has one. Okay, so now it's flat, no curvature, right? What happens if I do this? Do I have curvature now? No, no curvature, right? I mean, you could draw a triangle on this and sum up the angles. If I do this, it still sum up to 180 degrees. Pythagoras is still true. Right? So no curvature if you do this. How about that? Curvature? No. Now let me make an ice cream cone. Right? So we roll this up to get an ice cream cone. And as we do this, you see that we still don't have any curvature, right? Because I just rolled it up. Still no curvature. But look at this now. You see this point over there? This point? And that is what is called the conical singularity. So it's like an ice cream cone, that's why conical, right? The conical singularity. And you don't see any curvature as you lead up to this. And the way you can do this mathematically is that you literally just cut out the paper that was unnecessary when you roll up your ice cream cone, and then identify the points across the cone. So basically, you take this. And then you cut out a piece like this. And then you identify this point with that point, this point like that point, and so on. You just identify like periodic boundary conditions on fields, for example. And then it's effectively as if you had wrapped it up like this. OK, so you can also have non-curvature singularities like this. Don't expect them to come up in nature, but yeah, they might. Okay. Now, remember the fundamental problem we needed to address. In concrete solutions such as the Schwarzschild or cosmological solutions, curvature singularities are obviously present. If we take the Schwarzschild solution, calculate the Riemann curvature scalar, towards the singularity, we see that the Riemann curvature scalar blows up. And the same for cosmological solutions. If we calculate the Riemann curvature scalar, it blows up as we go back to the past and close to the Big Bang singularities. But as we discussed several times now, these spacetimes are highly symmetric. And if they were less symmetric, it could be that the singularities are avoided. So the big question is, do more realistic, that is to say, perturbed spacetimes also exhibit these singularities? Here's an example. If we take a spherically symmetric dust shell in fall, then in Newtonian gravity, we can study this. The mathematical discipline that studies that sort of thing is called catastrophe theory. And it would predict an infinite mass density to occur if we start with infinite symmetry, I mean, with perfect symmetry, but not necessarily if the symmetry is perturbed. In Einstein's gravity, we want to do the same thing now, and for that purpose, we will study singularity theorems. For example, to predict that black hole singularities really occur actually in nature, even if the symmetry is perturbed. And of course, we also want to post-dict a cosmological singularity. So the whole point of singularity theorems is that the prediction of singularities is made robust, which also means that the challenge for quantum gravity, once we develop such a theory, will be if quantum gravity is to resolve singularities, if there really are no infinities in nature, if singularities really are avoided, then quantum gravity somehow will have to overcome the singularity theorems. So singularity theorems are important also as something that quantum gravity will have to deal with, for example, to overcome. So if we believe that in nature, actual singularities don't occur, then quantum gravity will have to somehow find a way around the singularity theorem. We have to say some of the conditions are not met, or maybe the whole framework doesn't quite fit. But in any case, it has to be addressed. All right, so what is going to be our strategy for singularity theorems now? Well, first, we focus attention on singularities that can be identified by the existence of incomplete, inextendable, time-like, or null geodesics. So we are not looking at singularities that could be identified by space-like geodesics, but only those that are causal, time-like, or null. It's clear that these singularities that we discover in this way are important because observers traveling on such geodesics would actually have their eigentime bounded above in the case of black holes and below in the case of the universe, right? So for black holes, it would mean, well, your lifetime is cut short. And in the case of cosmology, it means that nothing that we are made of is older than so many billion years. All right, so could there be other singularities? Yes, there may be, but singularity theorems are not usually designed to detect them. So it might be interesting. Okay, so then next, in our strategy to detect geodesics, the basic idea is that singularities can be in the way of geodesics so that they can't be further extended. So the presence of singularity interferes with the property of geodesics of being extremal length curves. You know, geodesics are curves of extremal length. But do you know really all about this? Remember that extremizing the length of a curve leads us to the geodesic equation. It's an Euler-Lagrange equation. And the geodesic equation is a second-order differential equation. And what we obtain, therefore, is that at least locally, geodesics are paths of extremal length. And now, let me just cover that for a moment. Okay. So we know that space-like geodesics are curves of shortest proper distance. Okay, so if you take, for example, the shortest, a geodesic on the surface of the Earth between, I don't know, Toronto and London. The geodesic is the shortest path that a plane might want to fly, right? So in space, a geodesic is the shortest path. But in space-time, a geodesic is what? Is it still the shortest path in space-time? You think it still is? No, it's not. A geodesic in general relativity is not a path that is shortest. It's the longest path. So time-like geodesics that matter can actually travel, are curves of maximal proper time, of maximal wristwatch time. Yet this trips up a lot of people. Why maximal? If there's a time-like curve between two events, P and Q, then there are always time-like curves with a shorter eigentime. So let's say, for example, I take a spoon, coffee, and it was my coffee, don't worry, and I throw this. So event P is when I let go of it, and Q is when I hopefully catch it again. Okay. So there was an event of where it left my hand, and there was an event when it touched my hand again. So these are the two events that we are looking at, P and Q. If there were little people living on this spoon, and they had wristwatches, they could have measured their wristwatch time. Okay? Good. They could have measured their wristwatch time. Now, I'm claiming that this was the maximum wristwatch time that any observer would have observed who left my hand at the same time and returned at the same time. Why is that? Imagine that the spoon were not going geodesically, but instead I throw it and then somebody grabs hold of it and very quickly takes it a long distance and back, okay, just very far, like to Toronto and back, but so fast that it will touch my hand at the same time that it would have touched if it had gone geodesically, right? So the leaving event is still P, and the returning event is still Q. It's just a different trajectory now. It's no longer the geodesic. Now it's a very far traveling curve, not a geodesic, all the way to Toronto and back. Some enormous acceleration or whatever, right? Now, if there were little people on this spoon with wristwatches, and they had been taken on this ride to Toronto and back within that half second that the trip took here, they would have had much less time on their wristwatch between leaving my hand and coming back, because they are so fast. You see, time dilation. They would be traveling almost at the speed of light. So when they come back, less time has passed on their wristwatch. And gravity doesn't play a role in this because they're at the same distance to the center of the Earth. They just traveled along the surface of the Earth, right? So it's not like that makes a difference whether they are further away from the Earth or closer to it. Yeah, so you can always make the proper time shorter by taking a faster trip between P and Q. You can go arbitrarily close to zero, in fact. And the longest eigentime, the longest proper time that an observer can have is on the geodesic. All right, so now on in generic space-times, there always exist curves of maximal length between any two events. And what are, I mean, this was just here for our space-time, but what assumptions are needed to prove that this is still true on generic space-time? So how much do we have to assume? Now, it turns out that if you assume that your space-time is globally hyperbolic, you can already prove this. So it's not far-fetched to prove this beyond Minkowski space for very general spacetimes. Globally hyperbolic will do. Now, further, we will need to make a technical condition, an assumption of a technical condition. We will have to assume that matter obeys a suitable energy condition. Remember, we had the weak energy condition, the dominant energy condition, the strong energy condition. And we will typically have to use the so-called strong energy condition. Now, if we make this assumption, then we can prove that geodesics meet a divergence of a quantity called their expansion in a finite proper time. So what this means is that we're going to look at families of geodesics that you can view as geodesics that move in parallel, except that if you take geodesics that are initially moving in parallel, and then you let them travel towards a black hole, for example, you can imagine how they get focused. Or if you take geodesics, initially run them in parallel, then as space-time is expanding, those geodesics will travel apart from each other. If you run it backwards, the universe backwards, then these geodesics would get focused. Now, in principle, you could imagine that this focusing is just keeps going on and keeps going on, so the geodesics that used to be very far apart now get closer and closer. But what if that compression or expansion factor diverges? See, if the compression or expansion factor diverges, then that whole picture breaks down and you can no longer continue your geodesics. And that's how we will find that geodesics sometimes are not extendable. So these extremal length curves, these geodesics, cannot be geodesics with an eigentime, with a proper time larger than a certain finite amount, either into the past or into the future, which then proves the existence of a black hole singularity or cosmological singularity, as the case may be, a singularity in the sense that the geodesic is not extendable towards the past or the future. Right. So finally, let me give you a taste of a singularity theorem that we will derive. So let's assume that we have a globally hyperbolic space-time. Let's assume that the energy momentum tensor of matter obeys the so-called strong energy condition. And that's technically the condition that we will assume. This is the strong energy condition, and I will say something about it in a moment. Let's assume that there exists a twice continuously differentiable space-like Cauchy hypersurface on which the trace of the extrinsic curvature k, we will get to all of this, is bounded from above by a negative constant c for all points on that Cauchy surface. Okay, so these are going to be the technical conditions, but let me tell you what the physics of that is. This second condition basically says we have expansion of at least a certain amount. Let's assume that our space-time is, we take a space-like hypersurface, which is a Cauchy surface, and now let's assume that there's at least that minimum, a minimum amount of expansion going on at every point there. So we're no longer assuming that the expansion is homogeneous or isotropic, as for the Friedmann-Lemaître-Walker universe. We're just saying at least that much of expansion is going on everywhere. That's this condition. And that condition is a condition on the energy momentum tensor. It says no matter what the matter is in that universe, we assume that it obeys this condition here, namely that this expression here in the energy momentum tensor is larger or equal to zero for all time-like vectors, vector fields xi. Now, I wish I could tell you why that makes sense physically, but nobody knows why that would make sense physically. It just turns out to be the condition that you need, or a condition that is sufficient to prove a singularity theorem. And the reason why there is this funny combination of the energy momentum tensors is that, if you think about it, this is the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. Remember that in 3 plus 1 dimensions, and only in 3 plus 1 dimensions, the Einstein equation can be written in two ways, r mu nu minus 1 half g mu nu. Oh, we don't need this. Equal to some number times t mu nu, right? Gravitational constant. But we can also write the Einstein equation as, in 3 plus 1 dimensions only, as t mu nu minus 1 half g mu nu t equal to r mu nu, right? Remember? It has this beautiful duality where you could just swap t and r, and it's still true. And you can always choose units such that the gravitational constant is 1, so it's literally the same equation. And this expression here is that expression here in the strong energy condition. So what the strong energy condition means is not really intuitively, it's not a condition on an energy momentum tensor, really. That's not how it arises. It arises because we need a condition on the curvature tensor. Because we want to show that geodesics have to crash. As we extend geodesics back in time towards the beginning of the universe, assuming there is one, that's what we want to prove, that there's a singularity. As we extend geodesics backward in time, assuming that at a certain finite amount of time, on a Cauchy surface, the expansion was at least a certain minimum amount, we then run the clock backwards. We want to prove that then, if we run it backwards, we get a crushing of the geodesics, so that the geodesics actually collide and can no longer be extended. And in order to make that claim, that this expansion that we have on the Cauchy surface at a finite time, when we run the Einstein equation backwards, leads us to a crashing of the geodesics into each other so that they can no longer be extended, so that we have a singularity there. For that, we need to assume something about the dynamics, right? We can't use the Einstein equation itself because we don't know what the energy is there. We don't know, you know, how to solve the actual dynamics. We want to make a statement for all cases, for whatever the energy momentum is. And therefore, in order to draw the conclusion and get at a statement like, yeah, the geodesics crash into each other, therefore there's got to be a singularity, the next best thing to assuming the Einstein equation is to make an assumption of what the curvature does, right? So that we can go then from the initial condition of the expansion being at least this much on a Cauchy surface, run this backwards. If we can put a bound on what r mu nu does, just to say if we can put a bound on what this combination does, then we can actually prove a singularity theorem. So that's why this is not easy to interpret in energetic terms. So the logic is that, let me just get to the conclusion then. So the theorem says that if all of these conditions are met, in particular, the energy momentum tensor obeys the strong energy condition, which is to say that r mu nu has the property that r mu nu psi nu is larger or equal to 0 for all psi time-like. Here. If we have this condition on the Ricci tensor, then we find that no past directed time-like curve from a space-like hypersurface sigma can have an eigentime or a proper time or a proper length larger than 3 divided by c. C being the minimum amount of expansion that we assume at a finite time on a space-like hypersurface. So that means that all past directed time-like geodesics are incomplete. And that means more than just the existence of a singularity. It means that everything when running backwards in time runs into a singularity. It doesn't mean that, you know, it could be that the universe has a singularity in the past, but there's some stuff that avoids the singularity. No, this says that if you run the universe backwards in time, everything, every trajectory runs into a trajectory, runs into a singularity. Or put it differently, looking forward in time, everything comes from a singularity. And because of this word everything in there, it is not just like the singularity of a black hole, it's a cosmological singularity, because all of the cosmos, all of the universe, then comes from a singularity. All right, so the overall logic is that we can prove this, and therefore the existence of a cosmological singularity, a Big Bang, if, apart from some technical conditions like global hyperbolicity, we have as the really crucial conditions that at some point in time, there has to be a certain minimum amount of expansion everywhere, as is presumably the case now. Right? The universe is expanding everywhere, and there's no place in the universe where the expansion is smaller than a certain finite amount c. Right? This is what the extrinsic curvature is measuring. So that condition is presumably obeyed. Right? The universe is expanding everywhere with a rate given by the Hubble constant, and that's certainly not zero, not zero anywhere. So it's basically expanding everywhere. And in addition, we need to make that assumption that the Ricci tensor has this obeys this condition, for which we have no good reason to assume it, but we can translate it into a condition on the energy momentum tensor. And then we can ask, well, okay, is it reasonable for matter to obey that condition? So then we can say, okay, we know what the energy momentum tensor for example, a radiation-dominated universe is. And then we plug it in here and check, is that true? And it will be true. Right? So you can write down energy momentum tensors that would violate the strong energy condition, but reasonable ones will actually fulfill it. But you see, there is a bit of a loophole here, because you could have quantum phenomena that somehow get us out of that condition. All right, okay, so that was just a preview of the singularity theorem, and we will actually prove it next time then by following the geodesics back to the Big Bang. All right. Okay. See you on Tuesday.